HIV Hour is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.
You are listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM in the Brighton area and radioreverb.com online. Welcome to the UK's only radio show about HIV and living a healthy life. It's the HIV Hour. On today's show, we feature a rundown of the latest news and talking points about living with HIV from the Brighton area and the world at large. Information on Brighton's HIV organisations and some of their events. You can contact us at hivhour@gmail.com or you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram, hiv_hour. Also, you can listen and subscribe to our HIV Hour podcasts. Just go to Spotify, Apple Podcasts or Deezer and search for HIV Hour. If you miss the show on a Thursday at 7pm, then you can listen again on a Monday at 4pm and Tuesday at noon. Or indeed, catch up with an older show by going to the Listen Again page on radioreverb.com.
I'm here with Sue and Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm a bit hot. How are you, Tony?
A bit sticky in Worthing. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but yeah, I'm sticky.
Sticky in Worthing,
Well, yeah. We'll be moaning a couple of days when we get all the rain back, so we need to make the most of it, don't we?
Just think of the gardens.
Yeah, we need some rain. Be nice.
Have you been doing, Josh? You had a busy week last week, didn't you, with Pride?
Yeah, it was Pride, and because I've got my new job of working for Radio Reverb, I was organising the Pride Day fundraiser.
So yeah. That was. How did it go?
Yeah, it was a really good project to work on. It's quite hard. It's quite challenging.
It was a long day, wasn't it?
Well, not that. It's just the build. I think it's more the building up to get all the shows right and keep We had a GC an article and all that kind of stuff. So it was looking back now after it was like a big build up, and then on the day it kind of chill out a little bit. So this week I've had a bit of a quieter
Right. So,
How about you, Sue?
Yeah, being really busy, obviously, with my project Positive Voices. I'm having, I think I've mentioned this before, just retraining all of our volunteers to, instead of sort of talking on a one-to-one with the big C, as I'm calling it, COVID, obviously, we're now having to deliver our educational talks via Zoom. But you know what, you know, volunteers are stepping up to the plate as much as I expected them to do. So, yeah, we're getting talks in, you know, back to business. I'm not quite sure, but, you know, we're going to get there. How you been doing, Tony? You've been busy doing all your stuff?
Yeah. Just doing a bit of the hub stuff, the Worthing Hub. And we've got a few people we're keeping our eye on because they're not very well. So, yeah, it's just pottering along. My travel things... coming along a bit more. I've done a couple of bookings, so that's good.
Lovely. Yeah. Good. That's all good. But as always, we say this every week, we have another brilliant show. We're actually going to rerun a fabulous story we covered in 2018, and it's the story of Rebecca. Rebecca is a trans woman. And Rebecca's been living with HIV for 30 years. She's also written a book, which is amazing. I think it should be made into a film, but that's my opinion. We're going to be playing part one of her story, which was recorded in 2018. I just thought it was a great piece to play. So we're going to play the second recording, part two, the following week. We've got some other interesting news to do with the Viva Health campaign, who have joined in collaboration with the Terence Higgins Trust. A campaign that is targeting stigma. And we've got Gareth Thomas, which is, as you can remember, and the listeners may remember, Gareth came out last year of being HIV positive, and he is now sort of like an ambassador to trying to get those messages across. He's an amazing guy. He's done some and still doing some amazing work with the Terence Higgins Trust. So he is collaborating in this this new campaign, and it's hashtag HIV stigma. So we're going to hopefully have some information on that, and perhaps we're going to hear what Gareth has got to say about it, what his personal message is to everybody. So we've got some exciting things going on, haven't we, Josh?
Yes, and Ian Green is on there as well, isn't he?
Ian Green, he is the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And Ian, I don't know whether you know, guys, but Ian Green, he is the CEO of the Town of Seacon Trust. I've met him on many occasions and done some amazing interviews with him with other organisations and radio shows. Unfortunately, Ian Green caught COVID.
Right,
yeah. And but he did come through it, and he did struggle. So, you know, he's HIV positive. So, really passionate CEO of the Town of Higgins Trust. Really got a lot to say for him. And again, he's really thrilled that Gareth is on this new campaign. So it will hopefully be listening to Ian Green as well later on.
Yeah, and it's good to listen to a different perspective as well. Somebody who's had COVID and HIV as well, so it's interesting.
Yeah,
stuff.
Totally.
Yeah.
This is the world of
Radio Reverb.
So in the studio today, we've got Rebecca. So Rebecca, 30 years.
I know, Sue. 30 years plus two at this stage is now.
Right.
I've been living with HIV. And it's been a journey. Like, I'm a transgender woman.
Right.
And that's how I actually found out that I had HIV. It was back in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
I've been okayed by these wonderful psychiatrists that can inform you that you're okay to be a woman, even though you already know yourself.
Right.
Anyway, that's another story. But anyway, I went at that stage in 1987, it was called AIDS. And it was basically like there were tombstones falling from the skies. And you just thought that. You never thought this could happen to you anyway, for a start. And I remember, actually, I'd been okay to have my gender reassignment operation, but then it was compulsory to have an AIDS test as well. So you literally had to have an AIDS test.
Right.
And I thought, this is going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from a middle-class family. I've had a brilliant career. I'm a hair and makeup artist. I'm a model agent. That couldn't happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I had my test. And back then, you had to wait a long time for your results, unlike today. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unlike today.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I had to wait about a month. And at first I thought, oh, no problem at all. But as I was getting near the date to go back and get my results, I thought, I wonder, have I had sex with somebody that I shouldn't have? Did this happen? Did that happen? And I was thinking, no, I think I'm fine. Anyway, I went in, and the minute they asked me to sit down, I just knew there was something. Oh,
you got that feeling.
Yeah, and the look on his face. And then I was told I had AIDS, because back then HIV hadn't even, like, been, you know, there was such a thing as HIV.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, my God, what does that mean? And it means two things. It was a death sentence. Mm. You know, I was told I probably had 2 years to live.
Gosh.
And that I should tell my nearest and dearest. And also that I wouldn't be able to have my operation.
Oh.
Which was, I mean, it really, really, really kicked me where I've never been kicked before. It was so painful. I remember coming out of there, and back then as well, like, I mean, I think what people don't realise, that back then, you know, I've turned 60 in June, so...
You don't look it.
Thank you. I even look better on radio. And I just think, you know, that was nearly 32 years ago. I mean, we didn't have internet. We didn't even have really properly mobile phones, per se, you know?
Yeah.
So I couldn't go and look anything up like it is today. So we were told this, that was it, death sentence, no operation, your life is coming to an end. You know, and I was, 29 years of age, when my life should have been beginning. I'd been given the okay that I could have my gender reassignment operation. I thought I could have had it that year.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that this, my whole life is going to change, because before that, I had been a top hair and makeup artist and model agent, a top model agent in Dublin. So my career was going really well. And then the press got hold of it in Ireland that I was having a sex change.
Yeah.
So, of course, I lost everything overnight. So I thought, it was hurtful losing my business, but I thought, well, there's light at the end of the tunnel. I'm going to be Rebecca at the end of it. Right. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And then to find out, like, within 6 months of losing my career and everything in Ireland and being outed by the, you know, I was called a freak and I don't think paedophile was out, the name was out then, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
So people were taking their kids out of my model agency because they didn't want anything to do with somebody like me. And I kind of took that on board. And I thought, well, do you know what? The bigger picture is I'm going to be Rebecca.
Right.
And then to be in London and go for all these tests and then to discover I have AIDS and that I cannot have this operation. My world fell around me completely. And there was nowhere to run. There was nowhere to hide. Tell your nearest and dearest, I did that. I'd only just told them. Right. About a sex change operation. Then I'm telling good old Catholic Irish family, oh, by the way, I've got AIDS. Okay. So when I went home, I got the same cup, I got the same knife and fork. One of my aunts even brought me to a monastery because I thought that that would cure me.
Right.
Bless them. But it did work because I'm still here.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, I just remember feeling so isolated and so alone.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there wouldn't have been words around that in those days of like stigma and all of mm-hmm. that. But I was alive with stigma. Like nobody came near me. And even then when I came back to London and I was living here and I would talk among like my trans community friends mm-hmm. and I kind of, you have to let it out to somebody. You let it out over a couple of drinks or something. Mm-hmm. Then next of all, I'm being called this AIDS-ridden bitch. So for the first time in my life, I didn't fit anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't fit with heterosexual people. I didn't fit with the gay community. The trans community had rejected me. Family had rejected me. And I just felt, where do I go from here? What do you do? So I suppose that's when I discovered, and for an Irish person, this is quite late. I mean, probably the biggest thing in Ireland was they used to be more worried about me because if somebody doesn't drink, there's something wrong with them because I never drank. So then I started drinking alcohol and I discovered when I drank alcohol, it numbed the pain. And from that, then I ended up because at the time I had to get £7,000 together for my operation. And I had to get three for my boobs because at that, this was kind of like coming up to 1989 when there was one surgeon was prepared to do the operation, but he would charge you £2,000 more. How sad is that?
Just because of your status.
Yes, just because of my status. Isn't that mental?
Mental, yes.
So for me to earn that money, because at this stage I was jobless, I was unemployable. And the other thing open to me was CD nightclubs in Soho and the rest led to one thing. Somebody says, oh my God, you've been great. You should do escort work. You know, you have a great body. You should do this. I went, how dare you? I'd never do that. Within a week, I was doing that. And that was fine at the start. It was high class escort and it was champagne and then it was cocaine and then it was all of this and there was the lovely nightclubs and the designer, this. It soon went from that to working on the streets of Soho. Do you know what I mean? And it was a really bad place to be. And then I remember, and that happened quite quickly. That wasn't like something that took years to happen.
Right.
That happened within a year. And because somehow along the way, people would find out that you had AIDS
mm-hmm.
unless people wanted to know you. So then I ended up working on the streets in Soho and some of the working girl flats. And when I look back on it now, it's like, was that just a nightmare that I went through? And I remember standing on a corner one stage in Soho and I looked over and I saw this. I was pretty out of it, but I saw this reflection. I thought it was another person. I thought, who is she standing on my corner, bitch?
Mm.
And it was a reflection of myself. And I was like about 4.5, 5 stone. I'd lesions all over my face. I was missing teeth. It wasn't a pretty picture. And that actually, I remember actually crying at that stage. And that, for me, when I say I was crying, at that stage, I had been cried out. I didn't know how to cry anymore. but that made me cry. And then I remember being brought into hospital into St. Mary's, and I was in there for 3 months because I had AIDS-related symptoms. And they managed to get me okay after that. And then I got undetectable. And I got undetectable a few times. So every time I got undetectable, I would come off meds because I had this fear around the medication. Because the first meds that came out was AZT. So they used to be kind of a weird joke going around people with a, you know, well, if AIDS doesn't kill you, the meds will. Mm. So psychologically, I was geared up that all these meds were, I'm just a lab rat, mm. You know, and they're just trying to tick boxes with me. And then there were loads of side effects from all the meds. Then you had to keep some in your fridge and you had to keep some in your, you know, and I rattled when I walked with the amount of tablets I took. Mm. And if you were keeping some in your fridge, so if you were sharing a flat with people, then they knew you had HIV. So I would come off meds for that reason, to the point that I had built, I didn't realise that along the way I was building up a huge resistance to medication. So in 2007, I got clean and sober, and my life did start to change.
Radio Reverb. So in the studio today we've got Rebecca. What instigated that? What turned around for you to get to that situation?
A life support machine,
right?
And being sectioned for 72 hours in a mental home, where I couldn't go to the toilet, I couldn't shower, I couldn't do anything without someone. And I'd had a lot of friends that probably ended up in prison through drugs and through all of that. And me being an ex-heroin addict, crack, I'd done crack cocaine, ordinary cocaine, yeah. Every cocaine you could think of, and that I hadn't ended up in prison, I was probably one of the lucky ones. So for me, this sectioning for 72 hours, to me, was the nearest thing to prison.
Right.
And that was one place I did not want to go. Mm-hmm. That was one place I did not want to go. So I think, like, after taking an overdose of antidepressants and drinking some vodka, because I'd been 6 months sober at the time, and I just couldn't deal with the sober life, with the sober head. Because I, even though when I got sober first, things still hadn't changed. Things had actually gotten worse because I'd been such a nightmare drinking. I mean, I didn't care when I was drinking and drugging. Do you know what I mean? But my family suffered back in Ireland for it. So I drew them further away, and I didn't really have friends, what you'd call friends. The friends I had were people I went and did drugs with. So when I gave all of that up, there was nobody again. There was nobody again. So I remember I was 6 months clean and sober, and I thought, I need a drink. And then I thought, well, if I drink, I'm going to end up in a bad place. At this stage, I had already had the start of cirrhosis of the liver. And I thought, if I drink again, I'm definitely going to die. So I thought, well, I have a load of antidepressants at home. I get a half bottle of vodka. I'll take the tablets and a drink, and I'll be gone. It'll be over. And that's really how, it wasn't a cry for help. Yeah. I really wanted to die. Yeah. And luckily, a friend was in the area and tried to get hold of me and couldn't, and came, knocked the door, and then he heard me inside, kicked it down, and called an ambulance. And they had to give me insulin on the way to, I was, you know, and then it was a life support machine. I think for 3 days, and they said, if she doesn't come back this time, we're going to have to let her go. And I came back, and then I came out of the hospital. I thought, they don't care about me. They're letting me out after all of this. And I still had the tablets, a load of tablets at home. So I tried to reenact what I had done before I went in. So I went in to get the half bottle of vodka, but I didn't realise I was on the suicide watch. And these two big burly women came, and that's when I was sectioned.
Right.
That was my rock bottom. And that was October 2007. And to this day, I haven't picked up a drink or a drug since then.
Wow.
So it was quite something. It was like being a caged animal. Mm-hmm. That's how it felt. Mm-hmm. It was horrible. You know, and I think then my life did start to change somewhat. But it still had a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Still had
you see, it seems like you've come to a point where perhaps you wanted your lab to be different, you felt different.
Yeah, I think, you know, even when I, in some of my drunken states, I kind of got into a stage where I'd become this is how it is. Mm-hmm. This is how it's going to be. And then when I did get sober, I started to see light at the end of the tunnel again, and it wasn't a truck coming at me for a change.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, if I could only just get a couple of years, but I said, I knew I had a lot of making up to do. I knew I'd caused a lot of destruction along the way. And I don't mean physical, but emotional. I mean, I'm probably more to myself and then to my very Catholic Irish family. You know, which, I mean, it was like they saw the worst of it because it was printed on newspaper, and I didn't see what they were getting. And it was just, it was horrendous. And I also had a daughter that had been taken from me, you know, when I was very young, because I was transitioning and I wasn't fit to be a parent. So that was another thing that I managed to try and block out over the years, even though you never block it out. Yeah. So I knew every birthday, you know, when she, when she made her Holy Communion, when she made her confirmation, you know, when she turned 12, and then when she was a teenager, you know, and it was, and I probably just drank more on those occasions, but I always kind of, and her birthday was on the 22nd of December. So it's always so close to Christmas. So my Christmases were always kind of like in pain because sadness. Of that. Yeah, sadness. So when I did get sober in 2007, and then eventually when I did come out of out of being sectioned, I went to meetings, like my, you know, like support meetings around alcohol and drugs and all that. And then I found myself, I started to thaw out. That's how, the only way I can put it. I started to feel my feelings. Some of them were good, some of them weren't so good. Some of them I'd forgotten about. And then I realized for the amount of time that I drank and drugged for the decade and a half or two decades, you know, life had moved on, but I hadn't. Because it was almost like being stuck in, it's almost like I lived in a coma. It's the only way I can describe it. Because all of a sudden people were on these kind of phones, and it was Facebook. And it was, and, you know, and then I remember my friend teaching me Facebook. God, when I think of it. And through Facebook, I found my sister.
Oh.
And then I messaged her, and she immediately got it, because they thought I was dead. That's how sad it is. And I was just like really, really scary, you know, that they thought it was it. And then they came over to see me, her and my niece. And I was even more shocked then, because my niece, the last time I'd seen her, she was tiny, and now she's a woman. I think all those years. And then I went back to Dublin in 2009 for my birthday. My birthday falls on June the 6th. And I thought, oh, this, I don't know if this is such a good idea. Yeah.
Seems like you were on the verge in 2009 of changing your life around.
Yes, and that's how it was. And I went back to Ireland at the time, and I was really nervous going back, but yet it was the best thing I ever did, because I was only back a couple of days. I met these two guys that were opening a nightclub, and they wanted me to run it, and of course being a trans woman, and they wanted me in burlesque, and I thought I couldn't say no to this, and the money was amazing. So I took it, and I was working there a month and discovered I was working with my daughter, who I had not seen for 25 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Talk about fate. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Gosh.
So that changed the dynamics completely. You know, I couldn't run anymore. There was nowhere to run and nowhere to hide, as they say. And then I discovered I was a granny.
Ooh.
Wow. Yes. So, and it was really, at first it was awkward because my daughter had heard a lot of stories and all of that. But we sat down and we talked, and then she got to hear my side of the story.
Yeah.
And I think she then realized that I had no choice, that I had no say in it, and I had no legal rights on her. Then I met my 3-year-old granddaughter.
Oh,
and that just made my day. You know, today, my granddaughter is 13 and my daughter is 37.
Right.
So they're very much back in my life. So that kind of gave me, that made me see, oh my God, this whole sobriety stuff and everything is really working. So I thought, right, I can't do burlesque anymore. This wasn't how I imagined me meeting my daughter. You know what I mean? in full regalia of feathers. Mm-hmm. But that's how it was. So I decided I would go back into what I knew best. Mm-hmm. Model agency and hair and makeup. So I opened my model agency. And I was on breakfast television. And after I came off breakfast television, this woman rang me and said, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I said, well, yeah. How many? Everybody has. Mm-hmm. So I really think your story is remarkable. So within about a year, the book was written, very much my words, but obviously I needed a ghostwriter because I wouldn't have been, I kept repeating myself. Yeah. And seemingly you can't repeat yourself in a book. If you say something once, then that's it. And then it was published, and I called it His Name is Rebecca, because when my niece was very young, my sister heard her in the garden, her friend saying, well, is he your auntie or is he your uncle? And she says, all I know is his name is Rebecca. And I thought it's a very, very good name for a book. So, and the book changed things as well, because in the book, and I think it's very important to mention the book, because I talk about being a madam in a brothel in Amsterdam, about my sex worker, about my drugs, everything. But I don't mention HIV.
Wow.
You know, and that's quite remarkable. And people often say to me, why didn't you mention HIV? I said, well, I thought people would get over me being a prostitute. People would get over me being a madam. And all. Yeah. People would not get over me being HIV. Mm-hmm. So all these things are in the past and I can let them go. But I will be living with HIV to the day I die.
Yeah.
And people know that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's what they see. And then I remember thinking to myself, I'm not being honest. Once again, I wasn't being honest. You know, my daughter was back in my life. She didn't know I had HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And at that stage, I was undetectable and I had my medication from here. Yeah. And then I ran out in 2010. And I remember going into denial once again.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I've got a lovely house, I have a lovely car, I have my dogs, I have my daughter, I have my granddaughter. I have a lot of my family back in my life. And people have actually gotten to know Rebecca. You know what I mean? And I'm not a freak. And people actually like her. And I thought, I can't go into a HIV clinic and ask for meds. I just really felt I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought, well, I'm on detect. I'm fine. I'll get past. I'll get it. And as then 2011 came. The book had been launched in 2010 to a great success in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
People got to read my story. I think people started to really change their opinion about trans and especially about me.
Yeah.
And then I just thought to myself, I really can't go anywhere near, because at this stage I've made myself even more well known.
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm going to be fine. 2011, I started to notice I was getting very thin,
mm-hmm.
not just slim, thin.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started to notice my teeth blackening, my nails kind of were getting infected, and I'd got shingles, and I got a load of other, I kept getting kidney infections mm-hmm. and urine infections. And I knew in the back of my head what it was, but I was not going to announce it to anyone. Then I got asked to do a documentary on RT, like Would You Believe, it's called, mm-hmm. program. So it's about people's journeys.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I thought, and I, there again, I mentioned everything but HIV.
Yeah.
So by 2012, I was pretty ill. And 2013, I couldn't walk upstairs. And I was, my career was really kind of back in a good place as well. Mm-hmm. And I was doing really well. And I just, somebody made an appointment for me with my doctor and made me go. And then he told me, he says to me, you've got pneumonia. And I went, and then I broke down.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I've got something to tell you. I said, I actually have HIV. And he actually jumped back and went, oh, dear. And then I was put into a ward in Dublin. And I was put in with sex workers and drug users. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's how they treated HIV then. Mm-hmm. And, of course, because at that stage in 2013, Ireland weren't really putting a lot of their money into HIV, because I think a lot of people were coming across here to get their HIV tests. So the stats didn't add up.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, I'm being told I probably have about 18 months to live, that I've built, that my resistance to meds is huge. So there was nothing. And I remember kind of coming back when they let me out of hospital after about a month. You know, people were like, we're planning my funeral. And I thought, no, this cannot be it. I thought, I'm coming back to London for a second opinion, which I did. And in that second opinion, I was told that I was very ill, but I was lucky that there was meds coming out of America that would work with people like myself that had a huge resistance. So I started taking them. And I remember thinking, if I get undetectable again, I'm coming out of the shadows and I'm going to talk about it. And then I saw that there was a back to work program, a work positive program within Terrency Against Trust. I did that. And then I was allowed to kind of do a bit of internship. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met the wonderful Ben Truck and Positive Voices. Mm-hmm. And I remember going along and listening to her, this wonderful woman, this absolutely wonderful woman speak. I said, I'd never be, that of course is you. That is you. Miss Sue Riley. I couldn't believe it. I thought, I'll never be able to, I can't follow that. And because I've been so competitive in the past, I know you can't follow that one. And Ben said, you'd be surprised. So on my second one, I found I wanted to talk. And then I thought to myself, I have to be very transparent because I listen to you and you are literally, I mean, you're like a pane of glass, a very clean pane of glass that you see right through. I thought, to do that to kids in school, that's how you have to be. Mm-hmm. So I rang my daughter, I told her, and says, you go and shout it from the rooftop. She says, because when you walk into a room, you light it up and I love you. And that was enough for me. And from there to this, that's what I've been doing, you know. And I just, you know, when I think of it now, and then I did a boot camp for trans women in 516 mm-hmm. Street to kind of help them with hair, makeup and stuff, yeah. But also with sexual health stuff, mm. because even though things have moved on, Sue, you know yourself, mm. there's still a lot of stigma. And if you're a trans woman as yeah. well, there's even more, mm-hmm. you know. And I just want anybody out there that's listening to yeah. this, please get in touch mm-hmm. with us or with someone, because yeah. there is help out there. You don't have to do this on your own, mm-hmm. like I had to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And there always has to be pioneers somewhere along the line. And if I'm one of them, that's fine. But today, in 2018... there is help out there. Mm-hmm. And if you are on medication and you're undetectable, you cannot pass it on. And that's a really important message.
Absolutely.
And I think with both of us being mm-hmm. parents and that, when I found out about like that a pregnant woman
yeah.
on medication and undetectable, that's next door to a miracle.
I know.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think the work we do is great. Do you know what yeah. I mean? And it takes people like us to stand up and talk and tell our stories, mm-hmm. you know. And there's no need for people to feel, no matter what part of England you're in or yeah. wherever you are listening to this, pick up the phone, get in touch with us. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We're here to help.
And as you're aware, we've got Trans Pride in Brighton. Mm. Apparently it's the sixth year, and apparently they say it's going to be bigger than last year. So... you know, what a fabulous, unfortunately, I'm away that weekend, but what a fabulous event it's going to be.
And I'm gutted because of me having such a good gift of the gab, I'm going to Amsterdam to the World's AIDS
wow.
conference with Gilead Science to do talks. So, I mean, what more can I say?
I know.
But we're always here, aren't we, to listen and to hear,
yeah.
you know. Well, thank you so much for asking me to do this interview, Sue.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for your inspiration and hopefully we may have some listeners listening in, perhaps not trans themselves, but may know someone, may have a friend, and hopefully we'll relay some of your experiences, some of your inspiration for them, you know, to get help and support and let's try and break down to the stigma.
Yeah, and the barriers, isn't it?
Barriers,
yeah. It's so uh-huh. true.
Uh-huh. And I just want to say you look absolutely fabulous.
Thank you so much.
And, you know, thanks ever so much and keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Sue. Have a lovely day.
Thanks, Rebecca. Thank you.
Another fantastic new campaign was started about the 20th of July. Former Wales rugby captain Gareth Thomas has launched a new anti-stigma campaign. It's called Tackle HIV. Now, this is in partnership with Viva Healthcare and the Terence Higgins Trust. Now, the initiative will focus on improving levels of public understanding of HIV and breaking the stigma around the virus, including by bringing up-to-date information to new audiences through sport. As we work towards ending HIV transmission in the UK by 2030, it's absolutely crucial to challenge outdated beliefs about HIV. Now, Gareth has had a big impact in this area since revealing he was living with HIV last September. Now, to demonstrate the extent of the problem, Tackle HIV has conducted a survey of over 4,000 UK adults, and it found 61% of people surveyed said they would, if they found out a potential partner was HIV, they would or might end the relationship. The main reason for this was being worried about contracting HIV by 81%. Additionally, just 19% of respondents knew that if a person living with HIV is taking effective treatment, they can't pass it on to their partner. Now, this comes despite the messages being endorsed by hundreds of organisations globally and based on evidence from two large studies conducted over many years. Now, the fact effective medication means Gareth can't pass on HIV to his husband is something he wants everyone to know and shout about. So on the launch of the campaign, Gareth said, "Since finding out I have HIV, I have learned so much about the virus, about how it affects people living with it. As our survey clearly demonstrates, HIV is still misunderstood, and because of that, stigma still exists." And he goes on to say, "I have heard first-hand stories of how deeply this stigma and self-stigma affects people living with HIV, and I am absolutely determined to change this. That's why I have started the Tackle HIV campaign with Viva Healthcare. I am living with HIV and I am living a full and normal life. I'm taking HIV treatment, which is working. As such, I cannot pass HIV onto my partner. Now, science and medicine are so advanced, but public awareness attitudes lag behind. I'm choosing to tackle HIV for myself and for everyone living with HIV. Now, in a minute, you're going to hear one of the statements Gareth has said and talking about the new campaign. Also, a recording from Ian Green. He is the CEO from the Town Siggins Trust, has been quite instrumental in this new campaign.
Like most health conditions, HIV doesn't only affect certain groups of people. It doesn't discriminate. We are all potentially at risk. But science is winning the battle against HIV. And while there is no cure, there are effective treatments that enable people with the virus to live a long and healthy life. By working together, we can make sure people are able to get tested without stigma or fear and protect ourselves and each other. So get informed. Follow us on social media and check out our website, tacklehiv.org. Together, we can make a difference.
Have you ever experienced stigma? People like me who are living with HIV experience stigma so often, whether that's in our work lives, personally, through the media, or in the wider society. There's so many myths associated with HIV, which means that stigma can be really hard-hitting, and the discrimination that we feel is often has a massive impact on our personal lives and our mental health. We all have a responsibility to get educated, to learn about the up-to-date facts about HIV, of battling some of those myths. So I would encourage you to get involved in the Tackle HIV campaign. Go onto the website, tacklehiv.org, and follow us on social media. We need you to help us to eradicate the stigma associated with HIV.
Hey there, do you live in West Sussex and have HIV and listen to the HIV Hour? Well, we run something called the Worthing Hub. We're a non-profit in Worthing and we run weekly meetings. We do face-to-faces. We also run a virtual hub if you don't fancy coming down and seeing us, or we do a quiz on a Sunday night. You can get hold of us by seeing your local community nurse team, or seeing your either Lawson unit or the Rowlands Road team, or just find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. I'm Tony, and I'm one of the hosts on the HIV Hour. Speak to you soon. Bye bye.
Radio Reverb.
Radio Reverb. So I want to introduce you to Ruth. She works for the Terence Higgins Trust, and she's going to be talking about a really great new initiative here in the city of Brighton. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Sue. Hello. So I'm Ruth, and I work at Terence Higgins Trust. My role is health promotion coordinator, and that essentially I do the clinical testing in Ship Street in normal circumstances. So we have a drop-in clinic open to people every day of the week. But obviously that's closed at the moment due to COVID.
Everything seems to have closed, but do tell what's going on now.
Yeah, so because Ship Street is closed, we realise that we're not offering the service that we used to offer. And whilst people can order their own self-HIV tests online and do the tests in their own home, it's just not quite the same as coming into clinic and seeing a health professional, getting some really good advice. So what we've decided to do is set up what we're calling a virtual clinic, and that is a way of sort of simulating the clinic that we have at Ship Street via video call, so a bit like you and I are doing now. It will be an opportunity for people to ask any questions, to have some clear and informed advice. It's quite easy to Google anything nowadays, but it's not easy to get accurate information back. And when you're talking about something as important as your sexual health, it's good to know that you're getting the correct advice around
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, absolutely. And can I just say, not everyone, Ruth, not everyone, and I know there's so many, which is great, which is a great positive, there's so many different forms of tests and you can send away for the test kit, but not everyone wants to do that, Ruth, do they? The ones in support, perhaps while doing that.
Yeah, and it can be really useful to have support, because there's a lot of things around, especially HIV testing, in terms of window periods and what actually is a HIV risk, and having someone there that knows their stuff to give you that advice and information, and even just to support you in sort of taking blood yourself, because that's probably something that a lot of people haven't done before, and just having someone there to guide you and support you through that can really help and make the process a bit easier for people. And the same with any referrals that might be needed as well. We are essentially here for people's sexual health and HIV testing, but we also make referrals to other organisations and services if we pick up that people might need that.
Sure.
If you're doing a self-test at home by yourself, that's a service you're kind of missing out on.
So how can people get involved with it? And it's a fairly unique new thing that you're doing at the Terence Higgins Trust, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally new, actually. It's only been running a few weeks. As I said earlier, you can get a self-test from test.tht.org.uk, and that's free at the moment.
Wow.
Anyone living in
Brighton. How much would that normally cost, Ruth?
I think it's £15.
Oh, right. So someone would save a cost of £15, and especially in these circumstances, that might be quite a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. So if you're eligible and you live in Brighton and Hove, you put your postcode in, and the internet will, or the website will make it free for you, and it will be delivered in a discreet packaging straight to your door. So you'd order that test, and then in order to get a virtual clinic appointment, you just need to email virtualclinic@tht.org.uk, and we'll sort it all out for you, and we'll contact you via video call.
Right. Would it be your lovely self or some of your other colleagues?
It would be me and two of my other colleagues, Aisha and Marek.
Oh, yeah. They're all lovely there, aren't they, Ruth?
They are. We're all lovely.
And they'll see a nice smiley face, won't they?
They will, yeah, definitely.
So do you just want to give out them contact details again?
Yep, sure.
Make sure that everyone gets to know about this.
So to order your test, it's test.tht.org.uk. And to contact the virtual clinic, it's virtualclinic@tht.org.uk.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. This is really important. And I'm sure a lot of people will take this up, but especially if the test kit, which was £15, is sort of free still at the moment. So thank you so much for coming on, and well done, and continue the fantastic work and the services that you do in Brighton.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Ruth. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
HIV Hour is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.